fearing it would be too well protected, and it was. They would wait for me to set foot off my property, and then they would gang up on me like a bunch of schoolyard bullies. So I relaxed and got my beauty rest. In the morning, I calmly made myself an omelet with cheese and chives, poured some Tabasco on it, and nibbled on a piece of whole wheat toast. I cooked up some sausages, too, but most of them went to Oberon. I made us a pot of coffee to wash it down, some freshly ground organic stuff from Central America. I usually take mine black, but Oberon likes it with Irish cream coffee mate and cooled down with a few ice cubes.
"Did Genghis Khan take his coffee black?"
Oberon asked me. After my bath time story, he wanted to be the Genghis Khan of dogs. He wanted a harem full of French poodles, all of whom were named either Fifi or Bambi. It was an amusing habit of his. Oberon had, in the past, wanted to be Vlad the Impaler, Joan of Arc, Bertrand Russell, and any other historical figure I had recently told him about while he was getting a thorough cleansing. His Liberace period had been particularly good for my soul. You haven't lived until you've seen an Irish wolfhound parading around in rhinestone-studded gold lamé. "He didn't drink coffee," I replied. "Genghis Khan was more of a tea man. Or yak milk. Coffee really wasn't around in his time."
"May I have some tea, then?"
"Of course. I'll ice it for you after it brews so you won't burn your tongue." After I cleared away the dishes and Oberon Khan had enjoyed his tea, it was time to make myself a target. I strode out to my backyard, barefoot, and told Oberon to go into sentinel mode. I watered my herb garden from right to left, talking to the plants and encouraging them. The herbs grew in planter boxes around the circumference of my yard, all of which rested on shelves attached to my fence. Underneath these, I grew some vegetables in the actual earth of my backyard, leaving some real estate for Oberon to roll around on. The medicinal herbs took up most of the boxes, but I spared a few for culinary varieties. While this mundane chore was going on, I was using my connection to the earth to review my domestic defenses. Sending my awareness down through my tattoos, I looked for holes in my bindings, anything the least bit out of the ordinary, to make sure that I was alone and unwatched. There was a cactus wren checking me out from high up in my neighbor's Palo Verde tree, but he flew off when I made a throwing motion with my arm, thereby showing that he was a normal bird and not someone's familiar. When I came to the last planter box on the left, I put down the watering can and shook my head. "There's never enough time," I said, and pulled the box of herbs off the shelf and upended it on the lawn. The smell of rich loam and compost wafted into my nostrils, and the sight of a long, narrow package wrapped tightly in oilskin greeted my eyes. "Oh, look," I said in mock surprise. Oberon recognized my tone and didn't bother to turn his head. "Somebody has hidden an ancient magical sword underneath my herbs. That's so silly." This was my most vulnerable time, because while the sword's location was now revealed, there were three bindings and a cloak on the sword to prevent anyone, including me, from using it. The bindings were my own work, and it's pretty much all a druid can do. We bind elements together or unbind them. When I shapeshift, I am binding my spirit to an animal's form. Summoning mist or wind, that's a form of binding too, as is camouflaging myself or allowing Oberon to hear my thoughts. It is all possible because we are already bound with the natural world by living in it. We could not bind anything if the strings connecting us to all of nature were not already there. And because we see these connections and know that seemingly disparate elements can in fact be closely related, druids have a better grasp of divination than most other magical practitioners. Our knowledge of nature makes us superior brewers of medicines, poisons, and even potables. We're able to run tirelessly by drawing on the power of the earth, and we heal fairly quickly. We're useful to have around. But we don't shoot balls of fire out of our hands, or fly upon brooms, or make people's heads explode. That sort of magic is only possible through a radically different view of the world, and by binding one's spirit to extremely unsavory beings. The bindings on Fragara were simple but effective. One kept the oilskin sealed, one kept the sword in its scabbard, yet another prevented it from leaving the confines of my backyard. All of these could be undone with a bit of my blood and spit, fluids I don't give out for free. But the best spell currently resting on Fragara was a magical cloak around the whole thing, denying that there was anything magical about it in the slightest. Even though I knew my bindings were there, I could not detect them. And even though Fragora is one of the most powerful magical items ever created, and it should be practically humming with Fey energies, it just lay there in front of me like a stage prop. I knew the cloak worked on the Tuatha De Danann too, because Flitish obviously had been unable to sense it during her visit. The cloak was a spell far beyond my abilities. Those kinds of spells are not in the druidic milieu. A friendly local witch named Radomiwa had cast it for me. And in return, I had hopped a plane to San Francisco, driven up to Mendocino, and shapeshifted into a sea otter. This allowed me to retrieve an ornate golden necklace set with several large rubies, which were clutched in the hand of a buried skeleton she had stunningly accurate information on. She seemed mightily pleased to receive it, but even with 2 millennia of arcane knowledge in my head, I had no idea what it signified. That's witches for you. What sealed the deal for me was that the cloak wouldn't come off without a generous donation of my tears. Those used to be almost impossible for me to summon, I admit, until I watched Field of Dreams. When Kevin Costner asks his dad at the end if he'd like to have a catch, I just completely lose my shit. Any guy who doesn't is either in mixed company when he sees it or was blessed with an unusually sensitive father. I blubber and sob like a jilted girl every time I watch that scene, or even when I think about it. My dad would never have played catch with me. Never mind that he's been dead for more than 2,000 years and baseball hadn't been invented then. My dad's idea of bonding was throwing me in the tar pits to teach me a lesson, though I'm not sure what the lesson was, except to stay the hell away from Da. So if I ever think of a reason why the cloak should come off, all I will have to do is think of Kevin Costner and his chance to have a moment of peace with his dad, and the tears will flow like mountain springs. Bindings vanished with a drop of blood pricked from my finger and a bit of spit, I unwrapped the oilskin carefully to reveal a finely tooled brown leather scabbard, above which rose a golden guard and a hilt wrapped in strips of ancient rawhide, the grain long worn away. The blade was not suffused with the watery swirls of cooled steel. It was merely straight and chiseled and deadly in its purpose. A long leather strap attached to the iron rings on the scabbard allowed me to sling the sword across my back, and I did so to serve as both a lure and promise of punishment to those who would take it from me. I drew it thinking I needed to inspect the blade, but in truth it was more to admire it. I knew already that it was pristine. There had been no water damage to the scabbard. The blade sung and sparkled in the sunlight, and I marveled again at the strength of the cloak. Even though I knew it was Fragora in my hand, its weight and balance and familiar knotwork etchings on the blade greeting me like old friends, the pulse of magic I usually felt was absent. The firbolgs would not believe I had Fragora in hand until it cut through their armor and bones as if they were rice paper. "Come to heal, Oberon," I said aloud as I sheathed Fragora and rose. "Warn me of any approach, but do not attack unless I give you express permission."
"I'm coming to the shop with you?"
he asked, his ears raised in query. "Aye. You need to remain at my side until this business is finished. Do I need to remind you not to sniff my customers' asses?"
"You just did. And very subtly, too, thank you very much."
I chuckled. "I apologize if I have offended Oberon Khan. It is the stress of a death sentence that makes me speak without thinking."
"I will overlook it this time,"
Oberon replied, his tail wagging in good humor. "I'm also going to cast camouflage on you," I said, "so that if you remain still, no tail wagging, no panting, no one will see you. Even when you move, you'll be difficult to see, but you'll be practically invisible when still."
"Why do I need to be invisible?"
"Because after last night, people may come hunting you, and because if fairies come hunting me, I want you to take them by surprise."
"That's not very sporting."
"It is fine to be sporting when we hunt. It is ridiculous to be sporting in war, and often fatal." I cast the spell on him that binds one's skin and hair pigments to the hues of the surroundings, and he shook as if he were wet.
"Hey, that tickles," he said.
"Good enough," I replied. He trotted next to me as I pedaled to work, his nails clicking on the asphalt of the street. Following the noise, all one could see was a sort of heat mirage, just a wavy fluidity to the air. The Widow McDonough was already out on her porch with her morning whiskey, and she waved to me as I rode by.
"Will you be coming by this afternoon, Atticus?"
she called. I quickly glanced at her lawn and saw that it was due to be mowed. Her grapefruit tree could use a trim as well. A bonny young lass like you need not ask a man twice, I shouted back, hoping her ancient ears understood me. I gave a thumbs up to reinforce the message, just in case. When I got to the store, my only employee was already there. Saturday mornings were always busy and I needed the help. I switched to silent communication with Oberon as I opened the door. Go lie down behind my apothecary counter and keep your ears open.
Okay. What am I listening for exactly?
The approach of really heavy footsteps, the kind giants would make.
Morning, Atticus.
A bass voice rumbled in gnarly cheerfulness. Good morning, Perry, I replied. You sound abnormally happy. People be on to you if you don't watch it. A tall man of 22 years smiled back at me with recently bleached teeth. Perry Thomas had dark hair fastidiously groomed to look carelessly mussed, rectangular glasses with thick black rims, and a silver labret stud nestled like a pearl in the hair of his soul patch. He also had large silver gauges in both ears and a pale complexion that seemed to be the primary accessory for all goths. He was dressed entirely in black, of course, with a concert t-shirt of the psychobilly group Mad Marge and the Stonecutters, a studded belt, and skinny leg jeans that blossomed at the bottom into full-blown Doc Martens. Perry failed to notice Oberon padding right between us to take his appointed spot behind the counter.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be jaded and mournful that the sun is shining, aren't I? Don't worry, I'll get into character once the store opens.
Hey, cool sword.
Thanks.
I waited for him to ask me more about it, but Perry had apparently exhausted all he had to say on the subject. Young people can be so uncomplicated. I glanced at the clock behind my counter, 5 minutes to opening.
All right, give me a chance to get some tea brewing, and then fire up the soundtrack and we'll get going. I want both registers working today.
I had my apothecary counter and tea station on the east wall, immediately to the left or south of the store entrance. Wood shelves behind the counter held jars and little drawers of bagged herbs, many of which came from my backyard garden, and I had a couple of hot plates back there to heat kettles of water. There was a small fridge for milk, a sink, and some teacups always being washed and dried. I had a few packages of cookies and muffins for sale, but the lion's share of my apothecary business was in medicinal teas and bulk herb sales. I'd built up a regular clientele amongst the local senior citizens who came in for a proprietary blended tea that eased their arthritis and gave them a boost of energy. I called it Mobility. They felt about 10 years younger for about 10 hours afterward, and they blessed me for it, bought newspapers, and had their morning arguments about politics and young people at the 5 tables I had placed in front of the counter. One register was there, and one was in the back of the store, on the west side, to handle customers who just wanted something from the bookstore. My book inventory was basically an expanded collection of the religion and New Age shelves in Barnes & Noble, but I also had some serious magical texts behind glass on the north wall. Buddhas and incense and various busts of Hindu gods were sprinkled amongst the shelves. I would have put some crucifixes around, too, if there had been any demand for that sort of thing. But devout Christians tended to avoid my store for some reason. Celtic crosses were popular, though, as were various representations of the Green Man. Perry raised his eyebrows.
Open the second register? Think we're going to be that busy?
I nodded. I have a feeling it's going to be an unusual day. In truth, I simply didn't want him behind the apothecary counter where Oberon was hiding. If you get some downtime, see if you can create an end display for the tarot cards. Maybe we can sell some more that way.
Putting them out like that will make them easier to shoplift.
I shrugged. I'm not worried about it. I wasn't. Everything in the store had the same binding spell on it that I had put on Fragora in my backyard. Nothing could go out the door unless it had first been placed on the counter next to one of the registers. More than one would-be thief had been forcibly pulled back into the store by the items in his pocket.
Okay, I'll go turn on the music. Celtic pipes?
Nah, let's do some guitar this morning. That Mexican duo, Rodrigo y Gabriela.
Right.
Perry headed toward the back of the store where the sound system was, and I filled a couple of kettles in the sink and put them on to boil. A couple of regulars would be coming in as soon as we unlocked the door, so it was best to have the water ready. I glanced over at the paper racks and saw that Perry had already filled them. Some Spanish guitar came on through the sound system, its world beat suggesting to customers that here they could not only find refuge from corporate radio, but also much else that was stale and prepackaged and bereft of mystery. Perry strode back to the door, brandishing his keys, and said,
"Okay to open?"
And I nodded at him. The first person to walk through the door was my daytime lawyer, Holbjorn Hoke. He used the name Hal for modern American usage. He was dressed in a dark blue pinstripe suit with a white shirt and pale yellow tie. His hair, as ever, was immaculately styled in a Joe Buck haircut, and the dimple in his chin smiled sideways at me. If I didn't know he was a werewolf, I would have voted for him.
"Have you seen the morning papers, Atticus?"
he said without preamble.
"Not yet," I admitted.
"Good morning to you, Mr. Hauk."
"Right. Well, then perhaps you'd better take a look."
He grabbed a copy of the Arizona Republic and flapped it down forcefully on the counter in front of me, pointing to a headline on the right-hand column.
"Now tell me, lad,"
he said in his best faux Irish accent tinged with ancient Icelandic.
"Would you be knowing anything about this spot of trouble here?"
The headline read, "Ranger Found Dead in Papago Park." Casting off my American accent, I replied in kind.
"I'd be knowing more than is comfortable, just between me and me attorney-client privilege."
"I thought as much. I heard Coyote laughing last night, and he doesn't laugh at the harmless, does he now?"
"No, he doesn't, sir. I might be needing your help sooner rather than later."
"Right. I'll be seeing you for lunch then at Rue La Boule."
He named the Irish pub at the north end of Mill Avenue that was my favorite hangout.
"I'm thinking it's high time we had ourselves a heart-to-heart, and there's no reason it shouldn't be had over the best fish and chips in 30 states."
I nodded and said,
"At high noon, sir."
Though I could not figure where he had pulled the number 30 from. Which 20 states had better fish and chips than Rue La Boule? He had evidently been paying more attention to fish and chip cuisine than I had, and I must admit that I felt a twang of guilt. The finest fish and chips in the land was more than a mere trivial pursuit for me, and I had sorely neglected it for an abominably long time. Most places excelled in either one or the other, but rare was the establishment that paid equal attention to both sides of the culinary complement. Rue La Boule was one of the few Irish pubs that savored the chip as well as the fish, and its presence had been a determining factor in my decision to grow roots in Tempe.
"Right," he said. "See you then."
And he exited without another word. My senior regulars came in. Sophie, Arnie, Joshua, and Penelope. Joshua grabbed a newspaper and pointed out the same article Hal had shown me.
"God, would you look at this?"
he said, waving at it.
"It's like we're back in New York."
He said almost the same thing every day about one article or another, so I was oddly comforted by it. A lone searcher arrived, seeking something that wasn't Judeo-Christian, and buying a primer series in Buddhism, Hinduism, and Wicca. "May harmony find you," I said, and he dipped his head to me as he left. He had my respect. At least he wasn't content to be fed the diet on the television. And then something unusual walked through my door. She was a witch. Her personal wards radiated warnings, and even though I was not adept enough to know what they did or what they protected her from, I knew by her aura what she was. I hastily muttered a binding under my breath to keep all my hairs on my body. Witches could do some pretty heinous stuff with hair, blood, or even nail clippings, and I didn't know yet if she was friendly or not. Her appearance marked her as nothing more than a trendy college student, however. No black robes or pointy hat, no hairy moles growing on the end of an oversized nose. She had her brown hair pulled back in a ponytail, as carefully considered a decision as the makeup applied to her face and the pink gloss on her lips. She was wearing a white bébé tank top and a pair of oversized white-rimmed sunglasses. She carried a pink cell phone in one hand along with a jangling key ring. Her tanned, silky legs were bare beyond a pair of turquoise cotton shorts that strained at the boundaries of modesty. Her feet were slipped into a pair of pink flip-flops, her toenails painted pink with golden glitter sparkling in it. She took a moment to look around, inspecting the unseen more than the seen, before she turned and strode to my apothecary's counter. She appeared to be my assumed age, 21 or so, but I knew how deceiving appearances could be. I could not tell her true age without more information, but the eyes behind those sunglasses were definitely older than 21. She had seen things that separated her from the young and stupid. Still, she was less than a century old, judging by her aura, because it was still fluid and had none of the telltale markers of the truly old. If she could perceive the bindings around my shop and within them, she knew I was much older than I looked, too.
"Are you the owner of the shop?"
she said, approaching my counter. "I am. What can I do for you?"
"You are Atticus O'Sullivan?"
"Uh-huh." I nodded once. Someone had told her whom to ask for. I did not put my name on the window.
"I've heard that you can brew some extraordinary teas."
"Well, yeah, I can make you some oolong with an antioxidant booster that's simply awesome. Would you like a cup of that?"
"That does sound fabulous, but that's not the sort of tea I'm talking about."
"Oh. Then what you looking for?"
"I need a tea that will humble a man who is attracted to me, make me unattractive to him."
"What? Wait, you wish to be unattractive?"
"To this one particular man, yes. Can you brew such a tea?"
"You want a sort of anti-Viagra, if I'm hearing you right."
"You have understood me perfectly."
I shrugged. "It ought to be possible." She smiled. Her teeth were very white and straight, a toothpaste commercial waiting to happen. "But how did you hear about me?"
"I am one of Radomiwa's coven," she said, extending her hand to shake. "The youngest, actually. My name is Amelia, but I go by Emily in America."
I relaxed a little bit. Radomiwa and I had a professional and cordial relationship. She was the leader of the Tempe Coven, 13 witches who actually knew what the hell they were doing. They had a fancier name for themselves than that, but they didn't advertise it. Radomiwa was pretty powerful, and I would rather not get on her bad side. Oh, one-on-one I'd probably be able to dispatch her, but then her entire coven would come after me together, and they would chew me up and tell the Morrigan to go suck on it, because they most likely had their own goddess in their corner. "Why do you need me, Emily?" I asked, shaking her hand once and knowing she was trying to gauge my power through the contact. That didn't work too well on druids. We draw our power from the earth as needed, so she probably felt nothing more than the low-level power I was using to maintain Oberon's camouflage. It had caused more than one foe to underestimate me, so that was fine by me. I'm not into peacock displays of power. Isn't Radomiwa capable of looking after her own coven anymore? For that matter, you could take care of this problem yourself. You don't need me.
That is true, she said. But Radomiwa wants no part in the crafting of this particular potion. Neither do I. We require outside assistance.
And so you came here. I'm just a friendly apothecary who knows that witches are for real.
I pray you do not fence with me. I know full well what you are, druid.
Well, that was putting the cards on the table. I took another look at her aura, which was largely red and tossed about with the desire for power. She might be older than a century after all. College students these days didn't begin their sentences with, "I pray you," and they thought fencing was selling stolen car stereos. And I know what you are too, Emily of the Sisters of the Three Auroras. Her mouth formed a tiny O of surprise at my use of her coven's true name. If you don't want to humble this guy yourself, then I don't want to either.
If you would agree to this thing, then Radomiwa and her coven would be in your debt,
Emily said. I arched an eyebrow. Are you authorized to commit Radomiwa to such a pledge?
I am,
she said, and pushed a note across the counter to me. It was in Radomiwa's hand, and the splatter beneath it was Radomiwa's blood. Even dried, I could see the power in it. Oh yes, she had authorization. I snatched the note off the counter and pushed it down into my pocket. Very well, I said. I will agree to make this tea against your coven's pledge of future favor, provided that you personally agree to follow my instructions to the letter and pay my customary fees. She bristled a little bit, obviously expecting the note to take care of everything, but eventually she nodded curtly.
Agreed,
she said. Very well, I smiled. How long do you wish to remain unattractive to this man?
A week should suffice.
Then you will appear here tomorrow at this hour to drink a tea I will prepare for you, and every day thereafter for a week. Failure to appear will void our contract with no monies refunded.
I understand and agree.
Tomorrow you'll bring me a cashier's check for $10,000. Her eyes widened.
Outrageous!
She spat, and she had a point. I never charged more than $200 for my apothecary services.
That cannot be your customary fee.
If the Tempe Coven is unwilling to take care of your paramour's libido on its own, which they could do far more simply than I, then I am owed danger pay, I said.
But not that much?
She fumed, all but admitting the danger was real. I produced the note and offered it to her. Then I bid you good day. Emily's shoulders sagged.
You bargain well,
she said, her eyes downcast to my countertop. Her hands made no move to take back the note, but I kept it raised within her reach. You'll bring me the cashier's check tomorrow, then? I asked.
Aye,
she said, and with that I put the note back in my pocket. Then we'll begin tomorrow.
Not now?
Until I have the check, no.
Then, if I bring the check today, you will begin?
Aye, Emily, that is the contract I propose.
And once begun, you will not renege?
It was an unusual request to put so bluntly, but not an unreasonable one. All contracts should allow the customer a reasonable expectation of completion, but it seemed an awful lot of trouble to go through to make one guy go limp for a week. You have my word, Emily, that once payment is received, I shall execute the contract as stated, so long as you appear daily at the same hour to drink my tea. She spat in her hand and extended it to me.
Contract offered?
I stared at her hand and made no move to take it. If I spat in mine and shook her hand, then she would have some of my spittle to work with. Giving a witch your body fluids is akin to slicing off a choice cut of your buttocks and offering it to a werewolf. Received, I said, keeping my hands on the counter. You may consider my word my bond. She smiled triumphantly, not in the least offended, and exited my shop without feigning interest in any of my wares, though she pointedly waved at Oberon behind the counter and said,
Bye, puppy.
Just to show me she had seen through the camouflage. And I wondered, far too late, whether I had behaved wisely in agreeing to this business. Probably not. Witches had better ways of controlling their bodies than drinking a druid's brews, and if they were willing to put their entire coven in magical hawk to me and pay me 10,000 ducats to boot to get rid of one horny guy, then I was probably dealing with an incubus or something similarly nasty. The magic of attraction is little more than science these days. I would brew her a blend of herbs that would suppress her natural pheromones, which were currently exciting the fella, and then, with a bit of clever binding, cause her to emit the chemical signature of a skunk instead. Unless this guy was a closet skunkophile, she'd be looking at a wet noodle all night. On top of that, I was going to make sure she didn't get excited either, throwing in some natural monoamine suppressants. I had made this sort of brew before. I sold it to sorority girls as humility. They used it on their exes or their stalkers, or sometimes to end a relationship when they had no good reason to do so. Back when I first learned how to make a tea like this, I didn't have names for all the chemical reactions caused by the herbs. The herb lore was just as magical to me as my bindings were to a layperson. Science had taken away some of the mystery of the process, but none of the utter coolness I felt knowing that I could whip up compounds the pharmaceutical industry could only dream of. But I will not pretend I was helping Emily to feel cool. I figured to come out far ahead in the deal, because having a coven in your debt was serious mojo, and I could use plenty of that if the Morrigan's casting were to come true. Chapter 8. It actually turned out to be quite a busy morning, making my opening of the second register seem like genius. Perry never found time to mess with the tarot display until much later, and I never got time to read the full article about the park ranger, but I figured Hal would fill me in once I got to Rulabula. Come on, Oberon, lunchtime.
Burgers?
He lifted his head up hopefully. Fish, and we're going to be in a restaurant, so you need to behave and stay out of the way.
Same rules wherever we go. Behave and stay out of the way.
I waved at Perry and told him I'd be back in an hour or so. Mind the fortress, will you? He waved back. No problem. I slipped out the door and opened it wide so Oberon could follow me, then unlocked my bike from the stand and hopped on. No stopping to smell the trees and fire hydrants, I said. I can't be calling back to an invisible dog every few minutes to hurry it up.
When do I get to have some fun?
He whined. After I close up shop. You can play around at the widow's house. You can chase her cats in camouflage and totally freak them out. Oberon made chuffing noises, which was the canine equivalent of laughter.
Oh, now that sounds like a good time. I can sneak up on that calico one and bark right behind it. It'll hit the ceiling.
We chuckled about it together as we made our way up Mill Avenue, passing the bars and boutiques and the occasional gallery. Oberon told me about his plans to just put his paw down on the Persian's tail and watch what happened. Hal Hauk had already secured a table inside Rula Bula near the window, and he had ordered a pint of Smittix for each of us. I was both pleased and disappointed by the gesture, for it meant I wouldn't get to go to the bar myself and take a whiff of the barmaid. That's not as creepy as it sounds. Granuail, the red-headed siren behind Rula Bula's bar, was not entirely human, but I still didn't know what she was, and her scent was my only clue. She was a mystery to me, and a beautiful one at that. Long locks of curly red hair cascaded over her shoulders, which were always covered in a tight but otherwise chaste t-shirt. She did not earn tips from her cleavage, like many barmaids do, but rather depended on her green eyes, her pouty lips, and the light dusting of freckles on her cheeks. She had pale, creamy skin and a few fine golden hairs on her arms, which led eventually to fingernails she had painted green to match her eyes. She was not one of the Fae. I could see through all their glamours, and in any case she never blanched at my iron amulet. Neither was she undead, or she would hardly be working the day shift. She wasn't aware of any kind, which Hal had mentioned, but I had already determined using my own methods. I had thought she might be a witch, but she didn't have the telltale signs in her aura. If she had been anything sent from hell, I would have smelled the brimstone. But instead she gave off an ineffable scent that was not quite floral, more like a Pinot Grigio and mixed in with something that reminded me of India, like saffron and poppies. I was left to conclude that she was a goddess of some sort, masking her true nature and slumming here incognito, like so many other members of the supernatural community, displaced from points all over the world. The bonny Irish lass facade was even more shameless than mine, for I doubted that she was truly Irish underneath it all. She must be from some foreign pantheon, and I was determined to figure it out without asking her a thing. She flashed a smile at me as I walked in, and my heart sped up a bit. Did she have a clue as to my true nature, or did she only see the dim college kid disguise? Her face fell as I walked past the bar toward Hal's table.
"You're not sitting with me today, Atticus,"
she said with a pout, and I almost changed course right there.
"Down, boy,"
Oberon said at my heels with ironic relish. I ignored him. "Sorry, Granuail." That simply could not be her true name. She had to have picked it out on purpose to fit in at an Irish bar. "I have to talk a little treason with my friend," I said, gesturing toward Hal. She smiled.
"If it's a conspiracy, I want in on it. I can keep a secret."
"I'll bet you can," I said, and she arched an eyebrow at me. I felt a foolish grin spread across my face.
"Ahem! Time is money, Mr. O'Sullivan," Hal called,
and I snapped my head around, suddenly realizing I had stopped in the middle of the bar and forgotten what I was doing there. Hal's time was worth $350 an hour.
"Next time you take me to the dog park and you yell at me to stay away from the French poodles, I'm going to remind you of this,"
Oberon said. Embarrassed, I stalked over to Hal's table and sat myself across from him. Oberon squeezed underneath the table next to the window and waited for food to rain down from the sky. Hal frowned.
"I smell your dog."
"He's under the table, camouflaged," I said. Hal's eyes widened as he processed the sling across my chest and the hilt peeking out over my shoulder.
"Is that the sword I think it is?" he asked.
"Yes," I replied, and took a long pull from the Smittix.
"Was it employed in last night's mischief?"
"No, but I believe in being prepared. There's more trouble on the way, a whole lot more."
"Do I need to tell the pack?"
Hal asked.
"Werewolves, their pack always came first."
"Hey, it's my ass and the meat grinder here, not the packs," I said. "You don't need to tell anyone but Leaf about this business. In fact, I want to see him as soon as he wakes up tonight. Send him to my house." Hal looked as if I had just asked him to lick up vomit.
"Will you be paying the firm for his time, or will he?"
He was referring to the business arrangement I had with the vampire. Leaf and I had a unique understanding. Sometimes I paid cash for his services, and sometimes I paid him in fine liqueur, that is to say my blood. I had carefully neglected to mention that to Flittish. The blood of a 2,100-year-old human, and a druid no less, was a powerful, intoxicating, and extremely rare vintage for a vampire. I slashed my arm, drained a wine glass full for him, and then healed myself, and that was worth 12 hours billing to him. Then I washed out the glass and made sure he hadn't spilled any, because I was paranoid about my blood getting into the hands of witches. He paid the firm out of his own pocket for such a drink, and he had grown powerful over the years by it. I never saw him use the power, because nothing locally wanted to mess with him, but I think Leif was trying to become strong enough to mess with Thor someday. "Does it matter?" I said. "The firm gets paid either way." Our waitress arrived, and we paused to order 3 plates of fish and chips. The third was for Oberon, who was doing a good job of remaining invisible. When she left, Hal spread his hands and said, "Okay, tell me everything." I told him about Flittish, but left out the Morrigan. It wasn't everything, but close enough. "So a goddess from your pantheon has come and gone," he said when I had finished. "And you could get a visit from 2 more Irish gods before this business is through?" "Right. Angus Og and Bress. Plus Firbolgs."
"Plus those. I've never seen one. What are they like?"
"To you they'll look like a biker gang or something similar, but they'll smell like shit."
"Biker gangs can smell like shit sometimes."
"Well, that just makes the disguise better," I said. "The point is, you won't see what they're really like, because they wear glamour when they walk in the mortal world. In truth, they're giants with bad oral hygiene and a predilection for wielding spears. They used to be an independent people in the old days, but the Tuatha De Danann used them as thugs now."
"How much of a threat are they?"
"To my life, I'm not particularly worried. I'm more worried about collateral damage than anything else."
"That will bring the police into it."
"Which I'm sure is the point of sending them. Firbolgs are not renowned for their discretion." Our fish and chips arrived, and I sighed happily. It is life's small, simple pleasures that make it worth living longer than a century or two. I dropped a piece of cod down to Oberon and covered up his noisy chomping sounds with some noises of my own. "So, how can I keep Oberon from going to animal control?" I asked around a mouthful of chips and beer. Hal shrugged.
"The simplest way is to do what you're doing and lie," he replied. "Keep him hidden and tell anyone who asks that he escaped and ran away. In a month, or even less, they'll be so swamped with other cases that they won't be able to keep tabs on whether he's with you or not. Then you'll tell all your neighbors you've given up. You're going to get a new dog, and voila, Oberon reappears. Oh, and I wouldn't go hunting in the Papago Hills for a year or so."
Oberon whined at that, and I hushed him by dropping another piece of cod on the floor.
"This is all supposing the police actually track him to your place," Hal said. "They haven't shown up yet, have they?"
I shook my head. "Not yet, but since I think someone is leading them around, I have no doubt they will show up soon. Now tell me what to do if I don't want to lie." Hal stopped chewing and regarded me steadily for a few seconds.
"You don't want to lie?"
he said, completely off his guard.
"Of course I do. I just want to know what else I can do that I haven't thought of already. That's why I pay you, Hal. I mean, shit, come on."
Hal smiled.
"You really sound like one of these modern kids. I have no idea how you do it."
"Blending in is the best survival skill I have. It's just listening carefully and parroting, really. So tell me what to do if I'm forced to play it honest."
"Honest as in the police can see through your camouflage spell and know that Oberon is right in front of them?"
"Sure. Pretend I'm an ordinary guy with no magic at my disposal. Then how do I protect Oberon?" The werewolf took a long drink of Smittix and belched discreetly as he thought about it. Then he placed his hands flat on the table and said,
"Well, the only way they'd be able to build a case without witnesses is to use DNA matching. Oberon has no rights, but as his owner, you can demand they get a warrant before they do the whole unreasonable search and seizure thing. If they come with a warrant, though, you pretty much have to let them do what they want. And judging from what you've told me, if they get a DNA sample from him, the case will be pretty solid."
"That's right," I said, nodding.
"Well, another way we can delay things is to lodge some protest on religious grounds."
"How's that?" You protest against the DNA testing of your dog on the grounds that it's against your religion. I looked at him as if he were trying to sell me the ShamWow and the Slap Chop for only $19.99 plus shipping and handling. My religion has no objection to DNA testing. We didn't know what the hell DNA was in the Iron Age. Hal shrugged. They don't know that. Neither of us would ever get an award for ethics. The Iron Age, huh? Hal had been trying to guess my age for a good while, and I had carelessly given him another clue. I ignored his query and frowned skeptically. Will that argument work? No, the judge will throw it out on the grounds that your dog cannot possibly share your religious views, or something like that. But it will delay things for a good long while, long enough for you to figure out where to hide Oberon, if, as you say in this entirely hypothetical situation, you can't do it magically. Good show, old sod, I said in a cheerful accent straight out of Piccadilly Circus. I knew there was a jolly good solicitor in you somewhere. Oh, bugger off, Hal replied in kind. Just hide and lie and keep it simple for everyone, all right? I grinned at him. Will do. Where's the pack going to run next full moon? In the White Mountains near Greer. Did you want to come along? Occasionally the pack would let Oberon and me run with them, and it was always a good time. The only touchy part was my status within the group, because werewolves are obsessed with status. Magnuson didn't like to have me along because technically he'd have to be submissive to me, if I gave a damn about such things, and alphas aren't comfortable showing any kind of submission in front of their packs. I couldn't blame him, of course, so we worked out a compromise where I was a friend of the pack, a guest on equal footing with every member, essentially outside their hierarchy, and that kept everyone's hackles from rising. But it also meant that Hawk, not Magnuson, had to be my lawyer. As a second, he was already submissive and did not have to worry about debasing himself by serving my legal needs. I would love to, but it falls around Samhain, and I have some of my own rituals to attend to, I said. I thank you for the offer, though. My pleasure. He extended a hand across the table to me. I shook it, and he said, I'll take care of this bill and let Leaf know you want to see him when he wakes for the night. You call me if you need anything else, and stay away from that red-headed bartender. I don't know what she is besides trouble. That's like asking a bee to stay away from flowers. I grinned back at him. Thanks, Hal. Give my regards to the pack. Come on, Oberon. We both rose and headed for the door. Granuaile waved at me and smiled.
Come back soon and see me, Atticus, she called.
I will, I promised.
You don't even know if she really likes you,
Oberon said as we exited and I unlocked my bike.
She could be doing her customer service routine and stringing you along in hopes of a big tip the next time you come in. With dogs, you just go up and smell their asses, and you know where you stand. It's so much easier. Why can't humans do that?
Perhaps if we had a better sense of smell, we would, I said. Nature clearly favored your kind in that regard. When I returned to the store and told Perry he could take off for lunch, Emily the Witch was already there waiting for me, drinking a cup of chamomile tea Perry had made for her. He wasn't skilled behind the tea station, but he could boil some water and pour it on top of pre-made sachets as long as I labeled them carefully. Back so soon? I said. You must be eager to begin.
True enough, she said.
She stood from the table and minced over to me in her affected Barbie doll stride. She waved a check at me before placing it in my hand and saying snarkily,
Here's your danger pay, though there's nothing dangerous about making some tea. I never figured druids would be so avaricious.
I took it from her hand and made a show of examining it carefully, because I knew it would annoy her. She deliberately tried to provoke me, and one cannot sass me with impunity. I saw her face flush and knew she wanted to say something about my dilatory manner, but she wisely kept her mouth shut and contained herself to huffing. Eventually I said,
This appears to be in order.
I will begin your treatment because your coven has done right by me in the past, but if this fails to clear the bank, then of course that will be a breach of contract. Now, that was just unnecessary, even insulting for me to say, but she was such a snot I felt she deserved it.
Fine, she ground out,
and I smiled and went behind my counter to begin brewing her tea. I worked in silence for a while.
We were the only people in the store, and neither of us was in the mood to make small talk. Oberon picked up on it.
"Genghis Khan would never put up with so much attitude," he said.
"You speak the truth, my friend, but I'm as guilty as she is. We are not being very nice to each other."
"So I gathered. But why not? Isn't she the sort of female you normally find attractive?"
"If that was really what she looked like, sure," I said. "But in reality, she's probably pushing 90 or so, and besides, I don't trust witches."
"You think she's going to try something? Should I move behind her?"
"No, she knows you're here. She can see through the camouflage. But I think she's hiding something from me, and I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop."
"When did she drop the first shoe? I missed it."
"Never mind. Just listen. Once she drinks the tea, she will try to surprise me with something. She's waiting for the contract to be fully in effect before she says anything."
"Well then, give her back the check and send her back in. We don't need to play her witch's games. They always want to get you and your little dog, too."
"I knew I never should have let you watch The Wizard of Oz."
"Toto didn't deserve that kind of trauma. He was so tiny."
When Emily's tea was finished steeping, I set it on the counter for her. "Drink it as is," I said. "No sweeteners, and nothing sugary for at least 3 hours afterward. Be careful from this day forward not to eat anything for 3 hours before drinking this tea either. Insulin will interfere with metabolizing the medicinal compounds in the tea." That was complete bunk. I just made that up to mess with her. "And it'll take a couple of hours for the results to show up, so don't go hopping into his bed right away." "Fine," she said, and she began chugging the tea as if it were an Irish car bomb, completely disregarding the damage the hot liquid might do to her tongue and throat. She really wanted to get this over with. She slammed it down forcefully, as if it were a shot glass instead of a teacup, and she smiled malevolently at me.
"And now, Druid, now that you have entered into a contract from which you cannot withdraw without severe consequences, I have the pleasure of informing you that the man you're rendering impotent with this brew is none other than Angus Og."
Chapter 9. Now, that was a pretty good bomb to drop on me. It raised all sorts of questions. Foremost among them, where is Angus Og right now? If he was already in town and diddling the local witches to pass the time, then my paranoia was well justified. It meant he was far more directly involved in last night's mischief than I had thought. And it meant something else, which Emily was obviously waiting for me to realize. Providing her with the agent for his humiliation would make Angus Og duty-bound to kill me as soon as possible. He would no longer feel comfortable in taking the occasional pot shot at me from a distance. He'd have to actively hunt me down and make me pay. Yep, storm clouds are thrice cursed. First the Fae found out where I was hiding, then my dog killed a human, and now I'd earned the very personal enmity of a god who had been content for centuries to simply let his minions slap me around. Emily wasn't going to get an expression of even mild concern from me, though. She wanted to see terror in my eyes, but I walled that all off and pretended she was talking about someone harmless, like Snuffleupagus or Captain Kangaroo. "So you've come to me to make him wilt like lettuce," I said. "You could have done the job yourself by shedding that skin and showing him what you really look like." Wow. I couldn't believe I just said that. Her eyes bulged with the offense, and she whipped her right hand toward my face for a slap. Now, a slap from a normal woman I could handle. Heck, I'd suggest I needed one after saying something like that to a regular college kid. But a slap from a witch is simply not permissible, because sure as the moon rises full once a month, she'd use her nails to scrape some skin off my cheek, perhaps even draw some blood, and then she'd have me. A friend of mine fell prey to precisely this sort of trick centuries ago, and it had poisoned me against witches ever since. She had goaded him into saying something rude, slapped him, and left marks on his face. And then that very night his heart exploded inside his chest. I don't mean he had a heart attack. His heart had literally blown apart as if someone had planted explosives in it, long before gunpowder was invented. Some other druids and I had taken him to the grove and done a rudimentary autopsy to see if we could puzzle out why he'd dropped dead so abruptly, and we found this crater inside his ribcage. That's when I realized he'd been killed the moment she slapped him. I'd never avenged him. The witch got away,
and it still stung centuries later. That's why Emily's attempt to slap me got a very violent reaction. I knocked her arm down by crossing my right hand over my face, then I backhanded her really hard, much harder than I should have. I shouldn't have hit her at all. I should have just backed up out of her reach, but I tend to flare up when people try to kill me, which was what she was trying to do, make no mistake. She squealed and staggered back a few steps, holding her nose. I had broken it, and I sort of felt like an asshole, even though she had planned to do much worse to me. While she was still in shock and processing what had happened, I took the opportunity to try to talk her down from escalating it. You offered me violence, and I defended myself. I know that a slap from you would have meant the end of my life, or at least the threat of it, and I could not permit that. And if you're thinking about using magic against me in my own shop, I would remind you that discretion is sometimes the better part of valor.
And I would remind you that I am not powerless. Radomiwa will hear of this.
That's fine. I'll show her my security tape, I said, gesturing to the video camera mounted on the wall above the register, which clearly shows you swinging first. On top of that, you have now given me cause to believe you are a close associate of an old enemy of mine. I'd be within my rights to treat you as hostile.
Go ahead and try something,
she challenged, eyes blazing. I don't need to try anything, I chuckled. I'm in control here.
You go on thinking you're in control, Druid,
she spat, heading for the door in a fury, her flip-flops flapping noisily.
You'll soon find out you are very mistaken.
See you tomorrow for tea, I waved cheerily as she slammed through my door.
Oh, she's gonna want some revenge,
Oberon said after the door closed and we were alone. Don't worry about her, I said, grabbing a spoon and moving quickly around the counter. She's not the sharpest tool in the shed.
What are you doing?
Oberon asked. He followed me out to the floor, curious. I had squatted down on my haunches, examining the carpet. Ah, there we go. I found a droplet of blood on the carpet that hadn't soaked thoroughly into the weave. It was not much, but it would be enough. I scraped it off the surface and walked toward the door, peering through the glass window to see if Emily was visible. She was getting into her car, parked across the street a short distance north, a bright yellow Volkswagen Beetle. She would have to turn over her left shoulder to see me, so I darted outside, telling Oberon I'd return in a moment, and kicked off my sandals. I sank my toes into the same narrow strip of grass that had helped me heal my arm the day before, and I chanted a binding as I drew power from the earth. Emily felt the draw somehow, whipped her head around, and saw me standing there. I showed the spoon to her and smiled. Her mouth dropped open in horror as she realized how careless she had been. I saw her lips move and her brow furrow in concentration, so I had no time to waste. I licked her blood off the spoon and completed the binding just in time. She flicked her fingers at me, and I knew she had just hurled something my way, but all I felt was a gentle breeze. A couple of seconds later, her upper body was thrown painfully forward into her steering wheel, which caused the car's horn to beep. Ha! She had tried to blow the spoon out of my hand and knock me down in the process, off the grass strip and my source of power. Clever, but not fast enough. The binding I had performed was actually a ward, which meant that any spell she sent against me would rebound against her. The only way she could get out of it would be to get herself some new blood. She leaned back slowly and clutched her chest, probably bruised a rib or two. On top of a broken nose and wounded pride, she'd had a rough day visiting the local druid. It made me wonder what she'd been told about me. Did she know how old I was? Did she think I was some sort of lame-ass neo-druid, mucking about with holly branches and mistletoe? She turned around to stare daggers at me, and I gave her a jovial wave, then blew her a kiss. She flipped me off, a gesture that had zero cultural relevance to me, and then started up her beetle and screeched.